From KLW News in San Francisco, this is a special edition of Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Tenderloin.
Treasure Island.
Richmond, California.
We're spending a full hour discussing murder, incarceration, and redemption.
It was a burglary that turned into a murder.
Don Kronk spent 28 years behind bars before being released.
Most men my age have bought and sold 2-3 homes. Their kids are raised. They're retiring from their jobs. I got 3 boxes.
Nancy Mullane wrote a book about the people known as lifers.
What are we looking for after they've done that sentence? And then what happens when they actually do go before the parole board? And do they ever get out?
Mullane found that people sentenced to life with the possibility of parole rarely get out. And she wanted to understand why and what it costs society. That's the subject of this special edition of Cross Currents. Between 2000 and 2009, 57,000 men and women convicted of murder were released from state and federal prison. Let me repeat that. Around 57,000 convicted murderers are living among us. By the time they're released, they've usually served decades behind bars. They're a generation older than when they went to prison, and when they come out, they fade from view. No sensational headlines, no fanfare. We rarely think about them ever again. And they make their way on the outside in a world that can be very different from the one they left.
You know, freedom is, it's got its costs. My name is Don Kronk. I served 28 years in state prison for first-degree murder. I was sentenced to 25 years to life.
Don Kronk left San Quentin State Prison in April 2009. His time in prison and what it took to get out are the subject of a new book by reporter Nancy Mullane. It's called Life After Murder, and it tells the stories of Kronk and 4 other men convicted of homicide with the possibility of parole. Nancy and Don join me in studio. We'll start at the beginning with Don's story.
It was a burglary that turned into a murder. And the burglary was well planned. I was addicted to cocaine and at one point was selling it and then used everything and I owed all this money. And of course, in that underworld, you know, your cohorts are in the like situation. And I had this friend that was an ex-felon. He had done some robberies. And Mr. Allen, the man that I ended up shooting, he came to our attention through a third party that he owned a jewelry store and that he carried all the proceeds and the jewels home with him every evening. So the plan was we would go to his home, break in, wait for him, surprise him, tie him up. Actually, we had tape, duct tape, take his briefcase. And if we thought he may have had a safe, we were going to get him to open the safe and then leave. So that was the plan, and if obviously it didn't go that way, and we got to the house, we had masks, we had gloves, we had the tape, my cohort even had a club, he was a pretty stocky guy, he was going to be the muscle, I had a gun in my pocket, at the time I weighed about 155 pounds, and I was 24 years old, not intimidating at all, and I knew that if I were to ask you for your money, give me your money or else, you'd probably laugh at me. But if I had a gun, even if I just show it, you're probably going to comply. So I had it in my pocket. I'd never shot it and before this, and it was more just for intimidation. Well, it went horribly wrong. We were supposed to have the surprise. So when Mr. Allen came in, we'd surprise him, and it should have been relatively easy to get him, you know, in our control. Somehow he was alerted to our presence in the house, and when he walked in, I was in another part of the room, and I heard a noise. I thought it was my co-defendant. I walked out of a kitchen area, and there he was, standing in the door. And my thoughts were, how did he get in here without us knowing about it? And he just shot me. He just opened fire. The next thing I know, I was laying on the ground against the wall. I obviously had been hit, but I didn't feel it at that point, and I returned fire. I shot one time through my coat pocket, and it hit Mr. Allen. He died, and I didn't die. Looking back on it, it's a ridiculous activity I was involved in. It was just a series of very poor decisions coupled with addiction and, of course, greed. and selfishness and just thinking about myself. You know, so this happens. It takes seconds. I mean, it was just a few seconds and it was over. And I was in shock, apparently, because I still didn't realize that I'd been hit until I got outside. And then I felt something in my boot, my pants, and then a few minutes later, I could hear it in my lungs, a gurgling sound and all that. And I didn't think I was going to make it, but I did. You know, I always try to, whenever I make a public appearance or speak to anyone at all, I always make sure that I apologize for what I did against society. I mean, it affects a whole society, and not just the victim's family and my family, but society as a whole. And I really mean that. I am so sorry for what I did, and I can never, ever pay it back. And so all I can do now is try to contribute and give back the best that I can.
Do you remember your first day in prison, what that was like?
Well, I do. I had never been arrested. And so your handcuffs are on, you're in the car, you go to the facility. Usually it's a jail first. And at that point, you lose your identity. You lose who you are. You're stripped down. You're probed every part of your body. It's just so humiliating and embarrassing. And you're given a number. And from that point forward, you are no longer... I was no longer Don or Mr. Kronk, or I was just a number, C87286, period. And you soon learn that you will follow the rules. You eat what they provide when they provide it. You shower whenever you get the opportunity. You know, the lights go on, the lights go off. You will work. It's just... And then there's the machismo and the tension inside, and nobody wants to be there, obviously, and the depression. There are people in there with severe psychological problems. And then you're celled in this very small cell, which the SPCA, by law, cannot house a single dog in the size of, and there's two men in here. And you don't ever know who it is. You never know who it is. It could be somebody like you that's just trying to get through, could be somebody who's extremely violent and has no intention of ever changing. It could be someone psychotic, and you're forced to live in these cells. And so what you think or your opinion or your desire or wishes just don't count.
Don was sentenced to 25 years to life with the possibility of parole. I asked Nancy to explain what that means.
Well, in California, there's approximately 30,000 people living inside the prison system in the 32 institutions in the state that are living with a life with the possibility of parole sentence. The way the law works in California is when you go before the parole board, depending on over the last 20 years, somewhere between 3% and 10% of those who go before the parole board who have done that work are found suitable.
So just a handful. And I think that somebody from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation said to you, life without parole is essentially a death sentence.
Yes, that was Bill Sessa. He's a spokesperson for the California Department of Corrections in Sacramento. And, you know, when I first began looking at this population of individuals serving this sentence, it was just because I was doing a story on prisons. And that's when I first met these individuals behind the walls of San Quentin who had committed a murder and yet we're doing a sentence of life with the possibility of parole. So I began that question of, well, who are people after they commit a murder and they are given this sentence of a possibility of a second chance on the outside? And then what is it that we want from them? What are we looking for after they've done that sentence? And then what happens when they actually do go before the parole board and do they ever get out? And what we found is, you know, even if you're one of those 3% that are found suitable each year of the now 6,000-7,000 that go before the parole board, you still have to face in California a governor review because of a law that was passed in 1988 by the voters of California that gave the governor the authority to reverse someone who was that parole date. So
that essentially politicizes it.
Well, exactly, because the governor, you know, the governor has actions. The governor does appoint the parole board members. The commissioners on the parole board are appointed directly by the governor. And then after they have been appointed, they then have to be approved by the state senate. So there is, you know, this separation where the governor has the opportunity to have his voice heard in who he wants reviewing these parole board considerations. And the senate also has an opportunity. But to add then a third layer where it goes back to the governor after the person has been found suitable has put such a political weight on this process that is why the CDCR now says that if someone is given a life sentence with the possibility of parole in California, that they have a greater chance of dying in prison than ever getting parole.
Did you ever have to justify to yourself, well, who's going to want to read this book? Society has essentially shut its doors on these people, doesn't really care very much. Somebody who's committed murder, why do we care that they get a second chance?
Well, I think that's the part where the reporter comes in. And I think that, you know, as a reporter, when you have a question and you know you've never heard the answer, that's where there's something inside you just burns. And because that's our job. That's a reporter's job, is maybe everybody else is ignoring it. Maybe they're ignoring it because they've stopped asking the question. But when you hear that question in your mind, then you know, I've got to get the answer. And I thought, well, I'll just ask the warden. Then I'll just ask the officers. Then I'll just ask the CDCR. And every time I asked the question, I kept getting the answer, we don't know. We don't really know how many who have gotten out of prison on a murder conviction with the possibility of parole sentence have ever come back. So,
and you did find the answer, and the answer is?
I did find the answer, and it did take me from 2007 until 2011, so it took me 4 years of Public Records Act requests to finally get that answer. And what we found was that in 21 years, of the 1,000 individuals who had been sent to prison in California for murder with a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, who had been found suitable for parole and been released from prison, of those 1,000, not one went back to prison in 21 years for another murder. In fact, less than 1% committed any kind of a felony at all. So when you compare that with the recidivism rate of the other felonies that are committed in California and released from prison, that's 70%. So what we're actually doing is we're making it more and more difficult for individuals who are sent to prison with a possibility of parole, meaning they have to do everything they can possibly do. And, you know, in California, the budget that has been approved by the legislature for rehabilitation programs in prisons has been eviscerated. There are very few programs, there is no university level education because of a law that was passed by President Bill Clinton in 1996. All federal funding for university programs in prisons in the United States have been removed. So we send these individuals to prison in California saying, now do everything you can to better yourself. And then we remove all of the programs and all of the education. And they actually do everything they can to create those programs in prison. So when I started discovering this population behind the walls, these men who were going before the parole board and being reversed, or not being found suitable and then suitable and reversed 150 days later, men like Don Kronk, I realized that it was a population we just didn't know.
Coming up, Don describes what it's like to go before the parole board.
It's really, really challenging, and it seems that there's never really a right answer, no matter what the question is.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan here with Casey Miner, and we're bringing you these extraordinary stories that Nancy Mullane has profiled in her book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. And you're listening to KALW. Nancy Mullane got her start here at KALW. It was a reporting project for us that got her to start going to prisons and finding out what was going there, and then led her down this trail to write this book, this extraordinary act of journalism, and bringing us these stories that otherwise we don't have access to.
And I mean, we quite literally don't have access. I mean, I think Nancy is one of the only, if not the only reporter in California to have been granted some of the access to the prison system that she's gotten. And, you know, the book I just can't recommend highly enough. It's called Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. And it's absolutely riveting. It's simply a read that you can't put down. And it's the result of these years and years of work that she wouldn't have been able to undertake without the support of organizations like KALW that really gave her the space and the time and the attention that she needed to do this kind of in-depth reporting.
And we're going right back to continue with that story. But some of you may have heard we're in our non-interrupting funding drive. And the way that that works is that you call us and decide that this programming matters to you. And when you do that, we can send you a copy of this book, Nancy Mullane's book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. We also have tickets to see Nancy with the five men on stage at the Herbst Theater as part of City Arts and Lectures on Tuesday, October 30th at 7:30 p.m. You have to call, however, to get those tickets. You can go online to get the book. That's kalw.org. The phone number to call and become a member of KALW is 1-800-525-9917. And we will give you a thank you gift of this book, Life After Murder, or these tickets, or both, whatever you decide, 1-800-525-9917. But the time to do it is right now, Casey.
Yeah, it's absolutely right now. As Holly mentioned, we are doing these non-interrupting pledge breaks because we want to give you as much time as possible to hear as much of Dawn's story as possible. It is a story that nobody has ever heard before, and we want to give you a chance to listen to it. So please show your appreciation for that kind of non-interrupting membership drive that we like to run here. Please call 1-800-525-9917.
And if you listen to Cross Currents regularly, we have a whole room full of the Cross Currents staff waiting to hear from you. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call. I see that we have open lines. 1-800-525-9917. We're going right back to this story of Dawn Kronk and Nancy's investigation into what happens to these murderers with the possibility of parole. But we've got just a few seconds left, Casey, to get those phones ringing. And the reason to call right now is because you support this programming and we can't do it without you. This is a group project. That's how we do it. And we'll give you the thank you gift of this wonderful book, Life After Murder, or these two tickets to the City Arts and Lectures event when you call 1-800-525-9917.
That's 1-800-525-9917. We really hope you call. We hope that you're listening right now. And if you are listening right now, you should be calling. You love this program. You listen to it and you want us to go right back to it, which is exactly what we're going to do. So that's 1-800-525-9917.
And you can also go online to kalw.org. You can see all of the thank you gifts there. The only thing that you need to call for is, because our pledge members in the room are waiting eagerly to talk to you. And if you want these tickets to City Arts and Lectures that Nancy has so generously donated, 1-800-525-9917. I see open lines and we're not going to make our goal. And we really want to hear that you want us to do this non-interrupting kind of style of drive. And we keep hearing from you again and again that we want this. Well, the way to tell us right now is by calling 1-800-525-9917.
That's 1-800-525-9917. If you're interested in the book or in seeing the five men on stage with Nancy, you can go to kalw.org as well.
And that's 1-800-525-9917. You can continue to call or click as we go back to the program.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're speaking with journalist Nancy Mullane, author of the new book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. We're joined by Dawn Kronk, one of the five men profiled in her book. Dawn was sentenced to 25 years to life after committing a murder in 1980. In 1998, he got his first shot at parole. I asked him to tell us about going before that board for the first time.
So you finally get there and you know, I walk in and I'm handcuffed and I'm wearing my prison clothes and of course everyone is in suits and it's very somber and you know, it's obviously very serious. And then the hearing begins and you're given an opportunity to say, take responsibility for what you've done, talk about your achievements in prison, your parole plans and as far as you could make them while you're in prison. And
what kind of questions do they ask you?
Well, it varies. You know, it ranges. Sometimes it's just straightforward, and other times they're like trick questions. It's
like what?
It's really, really challenging, and it seems that there's never really a right answer, no matter what the question is. And then ultimately, 2-3 hours, this process will go on, and they take a recess. You come back, and you're denied. The first time I was denied, it was for 4 years, and it was shocking.
Explain what that means. So you go through this hearing, you're trying to convince them that you're suitable for parole. And then what happens?
Well, I'd gone in there with expectations. I had hoped that they would see my accomplishments and my change, and they would, you know, hear me speaking about this crime and the victim's family and the changes and things that have occurred in my life and, you know, their lives, and that, you know, it would really be seen as a real valid, viable thing that I had accomplished, and it's just glossed over. And I'm in there thinking that hearing the words of the law that says you normally shall be found suitable, and I'm hearing him tell me I will be denied for 4 more years, which means that I'll go back in the prison and I won't have another opportunity for 4 years. And during that time, you're expected to continue progress and you know, whatever improvements you can, education or what, you know, self-help groups, whatever, which I'd like to add is all possible because of volunteers in the community. Even though Schwarzenegger added the R, CDCR, rehabilitation, the state doesn't put a penny toward rehabilitation, yet they expect us to rehabilitate somehow. They'll teach you how to boil beans and mop a floor, but they don't provide education other than GED. And in the early years, they didn't even do that.
So you get denied parole. This is after spending 18 years mm-hmm. in prison, and you have to wait 4 more years. Mm-hmm. What happens the next time?
So I go to the next time, and I've got even more things in my arsenal. I have my AA degree and certificates and other things that I've accomplished and letters of support and community support. Again, a flawless record, no disciplinaries. So I thought, well, certainly they'll find me suitable this time because the law says you shall normally be found suitable. And I went through the whole process again and recess, come back, denied 1 year. And that went on 5 more times. And then finally, my 7th hearing, they found me suitable.
What was that day like for you?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, the hearings are so, it's such a cookie cutter, that the process, that when we come back from recess, you normally sit back at the tables, they turn the tape recorder on, and the verbiage is always the same. The board reconvenes, it's such and such a time, so and so are present, and the board finds you not suitable for parole, and then they go into this long spiel. So we come back, we sit down, they do all the legal stuff, and then they say, and the board finds you suitable for parole. And she goes on, just like all the times that I was denied. She said it so quickly that I didn't catch the find you suitable. I thought it was find you not suitable. So I looked over at my attorney sitting there, and I thought I'd see thumbs up, and he'd be smiling, and he was just almost collapsed in his chair. And I thought, well, maybe I didn't hear correctly. The first thing I think is now I've got to tell Kathleen, my fiance, denied again, you know, because they hold on hope, you know, just like us. And so she continued on with the normal verbiage. And then suddenly she looked at me and she said, now let's discuss why we found you suitable today. And that's when I just broke down. I just broke down. I uncontrollable crying, sobbing. The officers even brought me tissues and stuff, and which I thought was very nice.
Nancy, can you explain what you think works and doesn't work with the parole system as is?
Well, I think what works is when we sent Don Kronk to prison for murder, we as a society have expectations. You know, Don is a man who was using drugs, selling drugs, had gotten himself into a situation where he put himself in a situation where he shot a man and killed a man. At that moment, we as a society need to know that there is going to be he's going to be held accountable for that. And what we do is we take them to court, give them one of a number of sentences. One sentence could have been the death penalty. Another sentence could have been life without the possibility of parole. But based on the conditions of Don's crime, he was given life with the possibility of parole. But there's a long list of things that he is expected to accomplish while he's in prison so that when he goes before the parole board, that parole board is going to be able to determine whether or not he is someone who is, quote, no longer a threat to public safety. Now, that's a huge standard. That's a standard that means, and for many commissioners, they say that means they would be willing to have Don Kronk live right next door to them. So they're looking at this individual sitting across the table from them, and they're studying them. I mean, that parole board hearing is very intensive, and there is a certain cookie cutter element to it, as Don describes. But I think it also is they take that responsibility very seriously, the commissioners who sit across the table. And they have this huge folder that documents everything about their crime, about their time in prison. So if they are misbehaving in prison, if they are violating laws in prison or the rules, they'll know that. But the other thing is sometimes as much as smoking a cigarette can be a disciplinary action. So if you smoke a cigarette, they can say, you know, see, you don't know, you're not playing by the rules. The rules say no smoking, you're smoking, you're not ready to be out in society. Well, I think that, you know, my examination of this process and of these individuals has been looking at how the law actually works. We have a system of laws. And if the law says that you go to prison for this period of time and then you begin going before the parole board and you shall be found suitable if you have a good record, and then the commissioners that are appointed, you know, often do not, as we mentioned before, do not find these individuals suitable. And then they are not found suitable again and again and again. And these men are living these years in prison where they continue to do everything they can to prove, to show that they have, shown remorse for their crime. They have rehabilitated themselves, that they have the goal of redemption inside them, and that they have, when they are found suitable, they actually have to have a job on the outside. They have to have a safe place to live. So the plan is that if we let these individuals out, they're going to come back into society and they're going to thrive. But then we make it so difficult for them to get out that by the time, you know, and even for those who do get out, when they're released from prison, we give them a $200 after 20 years in prison, 30 years in prison. So, you know, I do think that the parole board has a place, and I think that that incentive has a place. But I think, you know, that whole process has just become very politicized. And, you know, when we appoint people to the parole board who are former DAs, former correctional officers, former sheriffs, you know, they come with a certain perspective. And I think one thing that might help make the parole board more representative of society's need or desire for redemption or for rehabilitation is to make that parole board more representative of society. You know, appoint individuals who have a broad perspective.
Coming up, release.
So now, finally, after all these years, I'm found suitable, and it's just, you know, I was ecstatic. Everything looked different. Life was different.
And we'll continue with that story of how Don Kronk ended up released. We're hearing about the parole system in California with Nancy Mullane. She's the author of Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. And you're listening to Cross Currents on KALW Public Radio, local public radio. I'm Holly Kernan here with Casey Miner. And we're just taking a few seconds in our non-interrupting fall membership campaign to remind you that this is a partnership.
And, you know, we take this non-interrupting thing very seriously. It's something that not a lot of other
people do and actually keep doing, because, and the reason we keep doing it is because you guys keep telling us that you love this, that it's such a pleasure not to miss any of the shows, and that you don't feel that you have to flee the station every time we come and ask you for money. And we respect you enough to do it this way. And we know that you respect us enough and that you appreciate this programming enough to give us a call, to call now at 800-525-9917. And tell us this. Let us know what you like listening to. Let us know that you like listening. Let us know that you consider yourself a part of this station. And we certainly consider you to be a part of it.
And like we said, it's local public radio. Nancy Mullane is local, who you're hearing from. She actually got her start right here on KALW. And I want to thank Olivia Sears, Jesse Rulio, Prasad Kilaro, and Joel Berger for becoming members. And I'd like to invite you to become a member as well. 1-800-525-9917. We have a goal of raising $2,000 and getting at least 20 calls or clicks in this hour. And we know we can do that because you know that this is a partnership. It's about you. And Casey, we have a challenge grant from John and Sharon Trefney from Golden, Colorado, and Helen Desai from San Francisco have put up nearly $400 to challenge you. So every dollar that you pledge right now is two for the station. 1-800-525-9917, or go online to kalw.org and you can see all of the thank you gifts. We have a very special thank you gift, which is the book.
It is Nancy's book, which is called Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. And I just cannot say often enough what an amazing book this is. Nancy is an incredible journalist. And more important, these are amazing stories. And they're stories that are happening right here in the Bay Area, basically under all of our noses. This is completely new to hear a story like Don Cronk's that you're hearing tonight. And Nancy is the person who's able to bring it to
us. And for a pledge of $75, we will send you her book. We can also give you tickets to Life After Murder. It's Nancy Mullane with all of the inmates profiled in this book at City Arts and Lectures if you call 1-800-525-9917. And this is the only time that we're going to be giving these tickets and these books away. So please do it right now. 1-800-525-9917.
That's 1-800-525-9917. And if you haven't called yet and it's because you're so excited for us to go back to the show, that's a forgivable reason, but not
it's
quite.
It's not. We have open lines, Casey. I can see that we have open lines. 1-800-525-9917. The only way that this works is when you call. We are 77% funded by you, by our listeners, and we like it that way. 1-800-525-9917. We need to make this match, Casey.
It's 1-800-525-9917. And if you call or click this hour, you will be able to get Nancy's book, Life After Murder, or tickets to see her and the men that she profiled at City Arts and Lectures.
So the book is a pledge of $75 or more, and the tickets are a pledge of $75 or more, or you can get both with a pledge of $120. But our volunteers will tell you all of this. 1-800-525-9917.
It's 1-800-525-9917. You can also go online at kalw.org.
And you can do that. You can continue to call or click as we go back to the program. Yay, the phones are starting to ring, Casey. We might make this goal. 1-800-525-9917 or kalw.org, and we thank you.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with ex-inmate Don Cronk and reporter Nancy Mullane, author of Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. Don Cronk is one of the men profiled in her book. He went to prison in 1984 for committing murder.
So, Don, you've just told us about going before the parole board for years and years and years, getting rejected, not found suitable for parole. Finally, what year was it?
2008.
Finally, in 2008, you're found suitable for parole. When did you find out that the governor had reversed it?
It was 2007. I was found suitable. And then there's a 150-day period where the governor has that opportunity. Well, during that time, it's just surreal. You've hoped for this for so long, and now you've been given it. And for me, it was a sense of validation that, okay, I believed, I hung on. All I wanted was fairness and justice to work. I admitted my crime. I was sentenced fairly, and I thought, rightfully so, and I'll do everything I can to change. So now, finally, after all these years, I'm found suitable, and it's just, you know, I was ecstatic. Everything looked different. Life was different.
I remember the day when I walked into the prison, and I had seen Don, I don't know, maybe three or four times before. I walked in and saw him standing in front of the chapel, and I remember looking at you and thinking, what happened? Because he was standing there in front of the chapel with this mug in his... Do you remember that moment? Mm-hmm. He was standing with this mug in his hand, and it was a coffee cup, and he had this... His shoulders were back, and his your legs were even, like, firmly planted on the ground, and you were looking out, and your chest was open. And I thought, oh, what? Wow. What's happened to Don Kronk? And I walked over, and I said, what happened to you? And you said...
I was found suitable for parole. You know, there is a weight. It felt like a weight. 100-pound weight was taken off my shoulders. And then conversely, I noticed that things that I had lived with for all these years, the smells, the food, the standing in lines, all the stuff that goes on in prison, suddenly it was like I was seeing it for the first time, because I realized that this could be over. This could be it. I could really be going home. I'd try not to think about it. You know, you know that the numbers are against you. You know the odds are against you, but you keep that hope. And so as the time went by, I'm waiting for the governor's decision. I'd be watching television perhaps, and I'd see somebody, maybe it'd be a local program and they're doing something, and I'd say, I would be jolted, like a jolt of electricity, and I'd say, I could be doing that. I could actually be doing that, you know, shortly. So, all the men that have gone prior that were found suitable and then denied, I mean, I knew that was there. That was the reality. And I tried to keep it, you know, in myself, but it's just such a overwhelming release when they finally say suitable.
And let's hear the tape of the day that you found out that the governor had reversed it and said, you're not getting out, you're not suitable.
We're walking down to 371 North, which is Mr. Kronk's cell.
Hello?
Mr. Kronk?
Yes?
How are you?
Well, I don't know. I've been sick to my stomach all day.
Well, here's the word.
I can tell because it's too thick, he says. If he were to be released, Lieutenant Robinson would just be holding one sheet of paper, not a half dozen, like he is.
Yeah, what can you do, you know? But I thank you for coming by. Nancy, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm disappointed. Very disappointed. But what are you going to do? You know, it's just been, if I'd have found out early this morning, it would have been, but we've just been all but throwing up all day, you know, and the later it got, the worse I knew the news was, so. But it's been, I'm exhausted, I'm drained. And I just got to shut down for a minute. I just want to be left alone, you know, yeah. Yeah, I really just want to be left alone.
That's Don Kronk while he was still in prison and found out that the governor had denied his parole. That means the parole board had found him suitable to be released on parole, but the governor overturned that ruling. It's part of a radio documentary Nancy Mullane made, and she's also written a book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. I asked Don what it was like to hear that scene again.
I had been through so much in my life, you know, from losing my parents while I was in there and being shot and then incarceration. I'd never been incarcerated. I never thought I'd spend one day in prison. And here it is 28 years later. And all that hope. And I knew, I just knew it was too late in the day. Normally when the governor's going to let you go, the few times that it happened, it's usually in the morning. And so here it is 5:30 in the afternoon. And here comes Nancy and Sam, and Sam had the papers.
This is Sam Robinson, who's an official at San Quentin Prison.
Yes. And I could tell by, there was, usually the approval is just one page, and this was several pages, so I knew that I was denied. And I just thought that I would handle it better. I thought that I was stronger and that I had tried to keep the reality of what was against me, the odds were against me. And even though I just knew at 5 o'clock, I know it's denied, I still wanted to hold on until I actually heard the words. And I just, you know, I said, sure, Nancy, you could be there and we'll talk and all that. And I couldn't even talk. I couldn't even talk.
When were you ultimately released and how?
I was released in April of 2009. And my parole officer came to the prison and picked me up and drove me in his car to my home in San Anselmo. And just that, it was just surreal. I didn't feel like it was real. This was a Disneyland, a Disney World ride times 10. I mean, it was just being in a car, sitting in the front seat without handcuffs was, you know, phenomenal. And then the sights and the smells and the colors and how fast everything is. All the electronic stuff. And it was overwhelming. But pulling up to that house and getting out of the car, and 28 years I had contained in three little boxes. That was my life. That's all I had to show for it. And it's an awesome feeling of joy, but, you know, the real challenge begins then.
There's this beautiful chapter in the book where Nancy writes about Kathleen, your fiancé, preparing for you to come home. And she didn't know which day you would get there. And she prepared. She didn't know what that first meal should be. And so she prepared everything she could possibly think of. And she put it all into the refrigerator. And it's just this poignant, really beautiful moment. What was it like on your side? What did you ultimately eat? And what was that reunion like?
Well, I told Kathleen, I said, you know, when I think the first thing I'd like to eat is some nice, thick, juicy pork chops. We're not allowed to eat pork, and we don't get much meat in prison anyway, and I always liked pork chops, and I just thought, and I, you know, throughout the years of visiting in the visiting room, other women that came to see men, friends of mine, well, they form a little bond and family, and so they would have dinner. Kathleen would often cook for these women, so for years and years and years, I always heard what an awesome cook she is. She's Italian, and everything is authentic, and so I couldn't wait, and I just thought, boy, pork chops. And I think that's what we had that evening. But yet, it, you know, I was looking at the house and doors that close, and lights I turn on and off, and comfortable bed and couch, and it was just, you know, it was just overwhelming. It's really hard to describe because it was everything I saw: trees, the street, the little dog, PJ, our little dog, books, everything was just surreal, bigger than life. And, you know, again, I was smiling. I wanted to embrace it. I was so, you know, overjoyed. But in the back of my mind, I knew I have to get a job. I have to make money. I didn't know if I could. All those years of preparing myself and selling myself to the parole board that I can do this, I can make it, I will make it. It was very intimidating as well.
Coming up, life on the outside.
Every day is such a blessing to me still. In fact, when I go to bed at night, I open my window that's right above my head, and I feel this cool breeze come in. And that's when I pray, and I also pray for the men inside.
That's coming right up on Cross Currents. And I'm Holly Kernan here with Casey Miner, and we're just going to take a few seconds before we return to that story, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. We're here just to remind you for a few seconds before we go back that this is a partnership, that we are a community-supported radio station. We are local, independent public radio. And I want to thank Nick Costellis, Jennifer March Soloway, Tracy Johnston, Christopher Barnett, Carrie Alvarado, Nina Raff, Ann Hawking,
David Kaufman, Sue Peterson, I hope I'm getting all these names correct, Mantra Robinson, and Audrey Ruiz Esquiz. Thank you all for becoming members on supporting KALW, supporting Cross Currents. It's helping us get toward this goal, and we're not quite there yet, but it's working. It's happening. You're doing it. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call if you want to talk to one of our volunteers, and they'll tell you about the thank you gifts that are available. Or you can go online to kalw.org. It's happening, Casey. We're going to make this pledge. We're going to get this match. We have a matching grant of $400 just in this hour. So please call us right now.
It's 1-800-525-9917. And thank you so much to those of you who have already called. It makes such a difference. It's 800-525-9917. And, you know, we all do this. We all listen to the radio. You turn it on and there it is. There's always a program. There's always people talking. But when you... if you don't call and pledge, that actually won't be true anymore here. We're 77% listener supported, and that means that we actually do need you to pledge in order to be able to be there for you whenever you turn on the radio to listen to whatever the show is.
And we trust that you will. We know you will. And when you do, we'll send you at a 75 or above level, we'll send you this book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption, by local author, reporter Nancy Mullane, who's a reporter here for KALW, who's this book started here at KALW because of an assignment. And Nancy has generously donated the books and tickets, if you call right now, tickets to her onstage conversation with City Arts and Lectures on October 30th for $120 level. You get both. For $75, you get either the tickets or the book. But give us a call right now, 1-800-525-9917. Say the number again, Casey.
It's 1-800-525-9917. And as Holly mentioned, we have a $400 matching grant that we're trying to make this hour. We are close, but not there yet.
And I see open lines, Casey. We need to get those phones ringing. And we only have seconds because we're going back to this story right now. We've promised a no interruption membership drive, but we can't do it without you.
It's 1-800-525-9917. It also counts if you click. You can go online at kalw.org. We're going to go back to the program in just a few seconds, as Holly said. But really do please take those few seconds to pick up your phone and call, to go online and click. Every single dollar really makes a difference.
And we'll give you a copy of this book, Life After Murder, as a thank you, as an incentive. Or you can get both the book and tickets to see the City Arts and Lectures. It's Nancy in conversation with all five of the men profiled in this book. That's for $120 or above. I mentioned thank you to all of the people who have already called. Some people have pledged $500, some $25. I think the average pledge is about $100, whatever fits your budget. But please call us right now, 1-800-525-9917, and let's go back to the show.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking with journalist Nancy Mullane, author of the new book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. We're also joined by Don Kronk, a man recently paroled after serving 28 years for murder. Don's only had one job in 3.5 years since his release. Employment is a major hurdle for ex-cons. I asked Nancy to explain some of the challenges.
When an individual who's done 20, 30 years in prison gets out and they get that $200. In fact, Dawn, I don't think you got your $200 right away. You had to wait for it.
It was like almost a year.
So the $200 obviously disappears. I mean, buy a bus ticket, you go out and go to grocery shopping and don't even think about first and last for an apartment. One individual who got out after 24 years told me that he went to look at an apartment with his fiance. And when he went, he got past the first application process. And when he went for the interview, they said, so where did you live last? And he was honest. He said, I was in prison. And they said, what for? Homicide. And they said, you know, you need to go find a felony friendly apartment building. And when he told me that, I thought, I don't really think there are felony-friendly apartment buildings, and there aren't felony-friendly jobs. What I've witnessed is that individuals get out. They have extensive training. They now are educated. They have a very good record in prison without any disciplinary actions. And then they have this huge hope, and then they're found suitable, and then they're reversed, and then they're found suitable again. And then, maybe they get out. Maybe the governor doesn't reverse the next time. Or as in Don's case, you know, they file an appeal. They challenge the governor's reversal in court, and the court orders the prison to release them, that the governor doesn't have weight. And they get out, and there's this huge kind of sense of euphoria. You know, they're on the outside, they're free, and then they spend months or years applying for every job they can think of. One of the men in that I profile in the book, Jesse Reed, he found work from midnight to 8 in the morning cleaning up from the Oakland A's, or the basketball. What is the basketball team in?
Warriors.
The Warriors, the Oakland Warrior game. So he would go in at midnight, and he said he'd never worked so hard. They would clean up the Coliseum. It was work that he could get. But to get a good full-time job with health benefits is nearly impossible. The one place people have found they can get work is if they are in an interview with someone who says, you know, I have a brother or I have a cousin who was incarcerated for something. And, you know, I would want that, you know, my brother or my cousin to have a chance. I'm going to give you a chance. So sometimes it's individuals who have known people who have done prison terms, and have gotten out, who are the most likely to give individuals a second chance at a job.
And is that probably the hardest thing about being out, the economic survival?
I think so. The rest of it is doable. You know, you can you learn to manage the rest of your life, but the jobs, I realized that I wasn't going to get a job, especially in this economy. I mean, there were people that had never been incarcerated that very skilled and couldn't get a job. So I decided, well, then I'm going to have to learn a skill. I was an electrician. So I thought, well, what can I learn that, you know, is needed and is today? So I went to College Marin and learned how to repair computers. And then along with that, I learned desktop publishing. And so I'm self-employed, actually. And I survive. I live, thanks to Kathleen and all. I live actually pretty well, but it's not enough to sustain me on my own.
Was there anything that you thought in 28 years being in prison that you were waiting for on the outside that then was a disappointment?
Boy, you know, every day is such a blessing to me still. In fact, when I go to bed at night, I open my window that's right above my head, and I feel this cool breeze come in. And that's when I pray, and I also pray for the men inside, and I just know that they would love, they would do anything to feel and smell this cool, fresh air coming across their face as they were in this comfortable bed. I, except for the employment situation, I mean, I just thought that I have skills, I'm personable, I work hard. I just thought I would have a job, a good job by now, and beginning to build a life. You know, I'm going to be 56 years old, and most men my age have bought and sold 2-3 homes, their kids are raised, they're retiring from their jobs. I got 3 boxes.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm here with Casey Miner. We were just listening to that extraordinary interview with Nancy Mullane. She's the author of Life After Murder, 5 Men in Search of Redemption. And you heard from one of them. That was the story of Don Kronk, who lives in San Anselmo now. We are in our fall membership campaign, and so we're making these special hour-long programs for you. And we want to take this, we have a couple of seconds only before we go to fresh air. And that's another local author, Michael Lewis, coming right up. But we want to take this opportunity to invite you to become a member of KALW, like Susanna Shire did, David Reither did, Marilyn Anderson, Angela DeFinis, and Paige Grossman all became members of KALW. Lots of new members are joining right now, Casey, to help us get to that goal. So we're really close to it. We probably need about 10 more callers at 1-800-525-9917, and we'll give you the book.
The book is Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption by local author Nancy Mullane. And we will give you that book for a $75 pledge. And a $75 pledge will also get you, alternatively, tickets to Nancy's appearance at City Arts and Lectures with the five men profiled in the book. If you want to donate $120, if you're able to do that, you can have both. You can have a copy of the book and go see Nancy and the Men. It's this amazing, amazing
And support your local radio station, because you are how we make radio here at KALW. We are local, independent radio, and we're that way because we get support from you, directly from you. And maybe you're thinking, it's not me. It is. It's you. And we're getting lots of people who are calling and becoming new members, Casey, which is really, really encouraging. But we're not at that goal. We've got $400 on the floor right now from, let me look at this. Go ahead and give the number out while I look up our challenge grant that we're about to lose.
Sure. It's 1-800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917.
Or you can go online to kalw.org. And when you do that, you're getting us closer to this $400 matching grant that we have from John and Sharon Trefney, all the way from Golden, Colorado. They listen there. And Helen Desai from San Francisco have put up their dollars to incentivize you to become a member of KALW. And the reason to do it right now is to get this book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption by local author Nancy Mullane, for $75 or above. And it looks like we have open phones, so I'm worried that we're not going to make our match here, Casey. We have literally about 60 seconds. 1-800-525-9917.
And when we say member, we really mean it. You are part of this station. We respond to you. You ask us for these non-interrupting drives. And not only do we not cut into programming, we actually make you twice the programming. We make hour-long episodes of Cross Currents all through Pledge, because we want to give you the opportunity to really tell us how much the station means to you.
Okay, we've got about 40 seconds left. This is about the power of listeners coming together to make something unique, which is KALW. It's valuable to you, so please call us right now, 1-800-525-9917. We know you're adults, so we're not going to take any time out of the air to tell you about all the thank you gifts that we have. You can see them all at kalw.org, but the time to become a member is now, and we're so close to getting this goal. I see one phone. We need a couple more to ring in. Casey, we've got 15 seconds.
15 seconds to call 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. Thank you so much for calling. You are what makes the station what it is.
And we could do it one person at a time, and we need you to keep calling as we go to fresh air, kalw.org or 800-525-9917.